Hey, we are going to finish Luke 21 if we are able here tonight. Last week, recall that there's a little gal put in a couple of small copper coins, and Jesus said she put in more than everybody. And Luke doesn't tell us this, but I wonder if verse 5, some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, that if they're wondering how in the world could we get this, if that's a lot. And maybe it's just Luke putting the two side by side for us to think that, or maybe that's exactly what they were thinking. But that generated a question. Jesus said, do you see these stones? See these stones that you're looking at, verse 6? Days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another which will not be torn down. Okay, so they're talking about the temple. Jesus says it's going to be torn down. And so that generated two questions. When and what would be the sign of the when? So maybe they're part A and part B of the same question. But they're really asking, when are the stones going to be torn down and how can we tell when it's going to happen? And so Jesus went into, and this is the review from last week. Jesus went into, in fact, they interrogated him. They didn't just ask him. The Greek word is very emphatic. They interrogated him and about when and what would be the sign. And his first response was in verse 8. What did he say? Verse 8. See that you're not led astray. See that you're not misled. Don't let anybody tell you something that isn't true about when the stones are going to be torn down. Okay, look at some of the things he says. Many will come and say, I'm the guy. I am the second coming of Jesus. But don't listen to them. You'll hear of wars and disturbances. You'll hear rumblings and grumblings, and just that's not it either. Don't pay attention to that. And he says, nation in verse 10, nation will rise up against nation, and that's not it either. In verse 12, they're going to arrest you. Who's the you? Especially the 12, but it would be any follower. I mean, what was Saul of Tarsus doing to any Christian? Putting him in prison and trying to beat a confession or get him to recant, as it were. They will put their hands on you and give you over to synagogues. That's verse 12. Also, you'll be led as prisoners to kings and governors. So they're going to mistreat you. That's not it either. He says, when they do that, verse 13, when they arrest you, and you think, wow, why would God let anybody arrest me? I'm a follower. Why would God do that? What did Jesus say? Indeed. You are thrust into an opportunity you wouldn't otherwise have. You can share your faith in me with them. And they can see that it's a faith that has substance because you aren't going to crack, you're going to yield, and you aren't going to buckle. You see, so it's an opportunity maybe to rescue the ones that are even persecuting you. And so he says in 14, verse 14, so make up your minds. I translate it, set it in your hearts. Make up your minds. Take it to heart. Set it firm. Today, Johnny and his father poured how many? 16 footers of concrete. I went down and looked at it and I said, boy, you guys are doing a poor job, aren't you? But they were setting something in stone so that the shed that they're going to build on top of it would have a good foundation. Jesus said, set it in your heart. The idea of this is not just wishy-washy. Oh, I like it today. I'm not sure I like it tomorrow. It fits my mood today. Doesn't fit my circumstances tomorrow. He says, set it in your heart. Set it in your heart or take it to heart or make up your mind that you're not going to prepare beforehand what you're going to say. What's going on when you're starting to prepare beforehand what you're going to say? What's happening to you?
You're actually boxing yourself
You're
in.
limiting God's ability. Okay.
Boxing. You're supposing what the situation's going to be.
Yeah.
You have no idea what the situation's
Right.
going to be.
You don't know what the questions are going to be. You don't know who's going to be there. You're also, if you think about it, when he says in the next verse, it'll be given to you, verse 15, it'll be given you what to say. The Greek is very emphatic. He goes, I'll give you a mouth. Utterance is literally a mouth, stoma. I will give you a mouth. So think about that. I'm worried about what I'm going to say. I'm preparing and worrying. And I am
Rod.
taking over God's responsibility, aren't I? That God says, I'll give you a mouth. No, I got this, God. I'll take care of it myself.
Right.
But it also would put you into a state of agitation, fretting and worrying. What am I going to say? It's
Right.
just, just be cool. Just be cool. You and Alfred E. Newman just sit back and what? Me worry?
And then disappointment when the conversation doesn't go the way you planned.
And then not only disappointment is a great point, but not only disappointment, but somehow the conversation went down a road I wasn't expecting, and now I don't know what to do. Yeah, so disappointed, but also off track, sidetracked, and untracked. And so he says, just make up your mind not to, what does it say? Make up your mind not to prepare beforehand to defend yourself. You want to guess what that word defend is there in verse 14? Not to defend yourself. Pardon? It's close. Apology. The Greek word is apology. But think about it. Apo means from, and logos is rational reasoning, the substance, the basic message. So we think apology, oh, I'm sorry. But apology is explaining why you believe what you believe. This is why I believe it. It's giving your reasons. Okay? So don't worry about that. You don't have to worry about giving your reasons. Now, didn't Peter say that he wants them and therefore us to always be ready to give a reason for the faith that's in us? Yeah, but that's not us on trial for our lives, wondering what we're going to say. So I'll give it to you. Anyway, this is the all of these things are not the sign. See, the temple's going to be torn down. When? What's the sign? These. That's not the sign. That's not the indication that it's about to happen. Okay? You follow me on that?
Me says algebra.
Yeah. Yes.
This is after the fact.
I'm sorry.
He said, I'll give it to you, not the Father, not the Spirit. He said, I'll give it to you.
Okay.
This is after he's talking about after
What?
his resurrection.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good thoughts. Where was I?
Could you talk about in verse 13 an opportunity? Okay, I missed
It's, you would be in a place where you would not otherwise be, and they'd be able to see your faith and how firm it is and how convicted you are by it, and therefore you'd have maybe you'd open the door of somebody's heart. Yeah, we did talk about that.
positive.
Exactly. I mean, this is not a negative thing.
Will give you a little opportunity you come refuse.
This is not a negative thing. See, this is, it's like Paul in Philippians 1. He says, because of my imprisonment, I have been able to talk to the entire royal guard of Caesar. They've all heard the gospel. Now, he wouldn't have had that opportunity unless he'd been arrested. So I'm going to put you in a place where you might not have been able to be before. It's kind of like Joseph had an opportunity with the chief baker and butler, didn't he? when he was thrown in prison in Egypt. Okay, so and I'm going to give you the now. Let me stop. This is a thought. Jesus said, "I will give you, I will give you." Like Scott pointed out, did we have in the 3 years of which Jesus was in his public ministry any observation of him having a dialogue, a discourse with the persecutors, and they could not answer him a thing? Now, if they couldn't answer him a thing when he was there in person, and he was going to give these guys, say, guess what? And we see it in Acts 4 when Peter stood up before the council, and the council said, why have you done this? And of course, he was thinking this, you know, spoken out when you weren't supposed to. And he said, oh, you mean heal this guy? And it got to the point where they could not answer. This poor fisherman, this old redneck fisherman who hadn't had an ounce of public training of either in the mechanics of speech or in the presentation of it or the formulating of it, they couldn't answer him. Why not? Because Jesus was giving it to him. See? And so, you know, that's a really cool thing to know that there is this divine power that enables us to say what we need to say when we need to say it. Okay, keep going. He says, you will be delivered even by your parents, even by your friends. And they're going to put some of you to death. You're going to die. You're going to die. But and you'll be hated by everybody on my account. Everybody's going to hate you because of me. How's that for a sales pitch? Yeah. Alan, I want you to embrace Jesus. And when you do, this is what it's going to look like. Now, not always, but there's times like in our culture, we're seeing more and more upheaval, more and more alienation, more and more hatred and vituperation and all those fancy big words, which means people are getting after each other. We're seeing it more and more. And sometimes it's just because of your political beliefs, but oftentimes it's because you believe in Jesus. I can't tell you how many times I have been booted off next door just because I posted something that looked like it was talking about Jesus. And just, okay, you got a 30-day, you got to wait for 30 days back on. Hated by all on account of my name, yet not a hater of your. And we looked at that. So at 16, you're going to be put to death. 18, not a hair of your head will perish. You struggle with that one. How can they put me to death, but my hair keeps living? You know, they have to exhume a body, and the hair is a whole lot longer and more unkempt than it was when they put it in. It just keeps growing for a while. Is that what he's talking about? How do you reconcile 16 and 18? You're going to be put to death, but not a hair of your head will perish.
So, is he talking in eternity then?
Probably. Let me say it differently. Your relationship with God will not suffer. They can kill you, but they, in another place, don't fear those who can kill the body, but after that, have nothing more they can do to you. Okay. That, I think that's what he's getting at. They might kill this thing I'm living in. Is that the first car you've ever had? The only car you've ever had? No. What happened to the other cars? They went the way of the world, didn't they? Yeah. Okay. But, follow me on this. Take one that's now in the junk pile or scrapped out or squished down and melted back into steel for some other car. When you had it and people saw you, that car driving up, what would they say? Here's car, not Alan's car. Here comes Alan. Okay, here comes Alan. You were in the car. You weren't the car. You were in the car. That's me. See, I am in this body. This body isn't me. I'm in it. Yeah, it's the vehicle I get around in this world in. But when this body dies, The rest of me doesn't. Not a hair of my head, see, metaphorically, is harmed. Okay, so I think that's what Jesus is giving. But none of these, all this review, not a piece of it, not a piece of it, was the sign that the temple is about to be torn down. So we get to verse 20. Now let's read. We're in Luke 21. I want to read the rest of the chapter as one whole, just so we get all of the information at least in front of us. Because there's some, would I be off, Scott, in saying that this passage is disputed, debated, contorted? I was reading in a commentary today, and the guy was just like, oh, there's two fulfillments of this. There's the lesser current one, and there's the later greater one. Where do you get that? Well, they get it out there. Eschatology is where they get it. They don't get it out of the Bible. They let their eschatology inform the reading rather than vice versa, rather than letting the reading inform their eschatology, let their eschatology inform their reading. So we just want to read this, get all the details in front of us, and then make our way through some of those, okay?
Sola Scriptura.
Luke 21:20. When you see, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, in order that all things which are written may be. Woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days, for there will be great distress on the land and wrath to this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword, and they will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. And be signs and sun, moon, and stars, and upon the land dismay among nations, and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are about to come upon the world, for the powers of the heaven will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to take place, straighten up, lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. And he told them a parable. Behold the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they put forth, you see it and know for yourselves that summer is now near. Even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize that the kingdom of God is near. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Be on guard that your hearts may not be weighted down with dissipation and drunkenness and the worries of life, and that day come on you suddenly like a trap. For it will come upon all those who dwell on all the face of the land. But keep on the alert at all times, praying in order that you may have strength to escape all these things that are about to take place and to stand before the Son of Man. Now, during the day, he was teaching in the temple, and at evening, he would go out and spend the night on the mount that is called Olivet. And all the people would get up early in the morning to come to him in the temple to listen to him. Your immediate sense at the reading of that. Did you catch any time aspects?
It's about to take place.
About to take place. Anything else you picked up?
That generation.
It'll take place in the generation Jesus was talking to, wouldn't it? So whatever we're looking at here is anchored in a time period in which those people lived. Now, I want to say this, and I want to say it really simply and clearly if I can. Anytime that there's language that is, I don't know what he's saying, or it's challenging, or what does he mean, sign and the sun, moon, and stars? Anytime there's language like this, it's, well, we haven't seen anything like that, so it couldn't have happened yet. That's what the route some commentators take. Anytime there's challenging or difficult or hard to understand language, you start with the things that are easy to understand. In this case, the time. Very simple. That you start with the time element and say it was going to be in that generation, it was about to take place, and he was warning them to be alert and active in prayer as they watched for it. So we have that, and then with that, we have the ability to say, I know when it was, I know that it had to be in that first century. Very few of them would live past 100 BC, AD. So it had to be then. Well, what's he talking about? And then I think we'll find help in the prophets using similar language, like the roaring of the seas. Well, what's that? So we had in here that there would be consternation or perplexity in verse 25 at the roaring of the sea and the waves. What's that? Well, I know from Daniel 7 and from other scriptures, but Daniel 7, Daniel was looking and the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and out of the great sea came the Babylonian and the Medo-Persian and the Alexandrian and the Roman empires out of the sea. Now, he's not saying they come up out of the Mediterranean because they had a submarine. The sea of humanity. And if we know that that's the way the Bible is using that figure, and Jesus is speaking to people who were accustomed to those figures, we can say, well, that's what he's talking about. He's not talking about coming up out of the Mediterranean or the Pacific or the Atlantic or the Arabian Ocean or any of those other bodies of water. He's talking about the mass of humanity, the society that sometimes is very calm. And like recently, very turbulent, maybe still is very turbulent. And out of the turbulence, new powers arise and some powers fall. When it's very calm, everybody's got their place and it stays that way. When it's churning and turned up, things change. And so we can say, okay, we know what the time is. And we've got this figure of the turbulent sea. So there's going to be, and didn't Jesus even say, you're going to hear war of wars and rumors of wars and nations rising up against each other? He said, don't be perplexed at that. When you have a great malcontent in the world, there's going to be that kind of grumblings and sword rattling and missile firing and things of that ilk. Okay, so let's get back then. And look at some of the details in here. He says, when in verse 20, when you see Jerusalem, now he didn't say Rome or Babylon or Alexandria down in Egypt. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. Now, there are probably three that I can think of, four. Times that I know of when Jerusalem was surrounded by armies in the Bible, when David captured it, be one. When Nebuchadnezzar captured it, that would be two.
Assyria.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sennacherib had Jerusalem completely. He said, I had Hezekiah caged up like a hen. Yeah, hedged up like a bird in a cage. And then when Rome did it, and there were probably other times when Jerusalem was under siege. But when you see it, Well, they didn't see David take the city. They didn't see Nebuchadnezzar take Sennacherib surround the city. They didn't see David take the city, but they would see Rome. So when you see the city surrounded by armies, when you guys living with me in this generation see Jerusalem surrounded by armies and recognize that her desolation is at hand. What does that mean? Her desolation is at hand. If you know the prophet Daniel, see, if you know the prophet Daniel, and these people would know the prophet Daniel, they know immediately the abomination that makes desolate. It talked about the defiling of the temple, the desolation of the temple. You recognize that her desolation is at hand. Over in Matthew 23, Jesus said, as he wept over Jerusalem, how often I wanted to gather you under my wings the way a hen gathers her chicks, but you wouldn't. Your house is left to you desolate. Okay, so God left the building, and now it's just an empty shell that used to be where they would meet with God. And so it's desolated. He says, when you see armies, that's about to happen. Then, when you see the ark, now you wanted a sign back here. You wanted a sign. The sign was not all these rumors and thunderings and grumbling, all that stuff, the resting, and that wasn't the sign. The sign is the Roman army around Jerusalem. That's the sign. You see that? Get out of town. If you're in Judea, go to the mountains. If you're out in the midst of the city, get out of the city. If you're in the country, don't go into the city. Why not? What reason did he give? These are the days of vengeance. These are the days of vengeance. Can you tell me what vengeance God had in mind? Or Jesus had in mind here?
Mine says punishment.
All the prophets, A to Z.
Yeah. There is one passage in the Bible that informs every prophetic message that follows. That's Deuteronomy 32, the Song of Moses. He talks about latter end. Mm-hmm. I'm going to see what their latter end is. And I'm going to read just a couple passages. Deuteronomy 32. Where do I want to start? In 28, he says, they are a nation lacking in counsel. I could go back to verse 7, where he says, remember the days of old, consider all the years of all generations. There's going to be a generation that looks back over all the generations. The days of old, he says, of them, they are a nation that lacks counsel. There's no standing in them. Would that they were wise and they understood this, that they would discern their latter end. They weren't thinking about what was going to happen to them when they rebelled against God the way they did. You can read the rest of Deuteronomy 32 and pick that up. Okay? He says in verse 34, it's not laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries. Vengeance is mine, and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip. For the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. For the Lord will, number one, vindicate his people, have compassion on his servants when he sees their strength is gone. So it's vengeance on some, vindication on others. And so we have, and I'm not going to try to expand on Deuteronomy 32 anymore. We would run out of time. But here, Jesus said that this is the days of vengeance. That which Moses was talking about, Deuteronomy 32, their latter end, these are them. This is when I'm pouring out vengeance upon the enemies of mine and vindicating my people. He said, verse 43, rejoice, O nations, his people. For he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land, his people. And so there would, Moses foresaw a time when God's wrath would be poured out upon his enemies and vindicate his people, but his enemies were the people of Israel. And Isaiah picks up on that same thought in chapter 64 when he says, my people will be called by a new name, and you, well, he's talking to Israel. The you is Israel, and my people are that faithful remnant of his people. Makes that delineation. Come back to that in a little while. So, Elsie says, these are the days. These are the days when God would avenge his people, vindicate his people, and pour out wrath upon whom? Verse 23, wrath to this people. Wrath to this people. God's wrath will be poured out upon Israel. It is not God's wrath being poured out upon the United States of America or Soviet Union or any of the nations that exist today. It was God's wrath being poured out upon this people when? In this generation. Okay? And so Jesus is very... And Ellen, it makes a lot of sense that he would be warning those people about what was about to happen to them so they could gear up and prepare for it. He wasn't warning them about what was going to happen to us 2,000 years later. What do they need to do about that? Not a thing. Okay? So, it makes, like a friend of mine said, otherwise it doesn't even make good nonsense. Okay. Now watch. Verse 22. Still in 22. For these are the days of vengeance in order that. And what do you mean by in order that? What does that mean? In order that. Pardon?
As to?
Okay. So that, in order, there's something that needs to be done, and we're doing this to get that accomplished. The vengeance is in order that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Now, what's the power of the word all in this? If in that generation, among those people, all things which are written are fulfilled, what does that leave for our generation?
Not much.
Nothing. Yeah. All take away all is nothing. And so,
all or nothing.
Yeah. And so the idea that Jesus is forecasting something for later days doesn't make sense. Okay. That all things which are written may be. Scott, do you realize how much exegesis could take place, all things that are written? We could spend 5 or 6 years just going through the prophets to see all things that were written that would be culminated in the death of Jesus. Now, this is something, Alan, that you'll want to remember, always want to remember. Everybody always remember this. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, and this is a comment now really on verse 23, wrath to this people. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, Michael knows what I'm going to say here. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul said concerning the Christians in Thessalonica, he says, you become imitators of the believers of in Christ Jesus that are in Judea, because you endured the same sufferings at the hands of your countrymen as they did from the Jews. Verse 15, who both killed the Lord Jesus and the prophets and drove us out. So what do you get right there? You get a sense of how much hostility and resistance the Jewish population had to what God was doing through Jesus, through his prophets, and through the followers. Okay, that's what they did. They are not pleasing to God, but hostile to all men, hindering us from speaking to the Gentiles that they might be saved, with the result that they always fill up the measure of their sins. You remember what Jesus said in Matthew 23? Fill up the measure of sin. And then what would happen? The sentence of Gehenna. Now, the sentence of Gehenna goes all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar when he was besieging Jerusalem. And all the trash and garbage and dead bodies, the only place, safe place they had, that were accumulating inside the city, the only safe place they had was dump them over the wall into Gehenna. That's a sentence of Gehenna. You're going to go through that same thing again. Okay, that upon you, where was I just reading? With the result that they always fill up the measure of their sins. That's Matthew 23 also, where Jesus said, fill up the measure of your sins. Upon you will come the sentence of Gehenna. But now watch verse 16. It's 1 Thessalonians 2:16. But wrath has come upon them to the utmost. Now that word to the utmost, that phrase is literally to an end. Literally. Wrath has come upon them to an end. And so here in Luke 21, we have that these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written in the may be fulfilled. Woe to those who were child and to nurse babes in those days, because there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. So imagine when he said, flee to the mountains, and you're 23 years old, single, and just able-bodied, fleeing to the mountains would be a piece of cake. But you're, say, 23 years old, married, 8 months pregnant, fleeing to the mountains. You know what the word woe means? It means basically, oh no. Oh no. It's not a statement of condemnation. It's an expression of, that's too bad. Pity, too bad. Oh no, whoa. That's, in fact, it's just the word itself. Oh, I mean, oh, is the Greek word. And we transliterate it, whoa. But it means this is going to be hard. It's a hardship because these are days of wrath, of distress on the land, and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword. So Jerusalem, surround, get out of town, because this is when the end begins. The beginning of the end? Is that an oxymoron? Well, no, because you got the beginning of the end, the middle of the end, and the end of the end. But this is the beginning. So if you're paying attention to Jesus, and this is a wrath, a great distress that has to come. And I meant to point this out under the great distress, the vengeance. If you go to Leviticus 26 or Deuteronomy 28, they're generational. They're one generation of 40 years apart. Moses laid down what are known as the blessings. If you follow me, I'll bless you, bless you, bless you, bless you. But if you don't follow me, curse, 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 to a point of destruction and eradication. And so we'll talk about wrath and fulfilling all things that were written, about the curse coming upon the people. And we read over in Galatians 3 that Jesus Christ did what? Became the curse for us, so to deliver us one by one from that. Anyway, a lot of spin-offs on this. This is rich and thick stuff.
Interesting thing.
Yeah.
Two books.
Two.
That describe this fleeing are mentioned, that old Christians fled Jerusalem just prior to that. Was the War of the Jews,
uh-huh,
by Flavius Josephus.
Yes.
And History of the Christian Church by Eusebius.
By Eusebius, yeah.
He mentions that there was almost...
almost no Christians.
No Christians killed in
the city. Anybody who believed Jesus would leave. If they valued their lives and their relationship with Jesus, they would leave. If they said, oh, I got to sit back and because my people are here, my things are here, they'd be like Lot's wife, lost in the destruction. And he made that comparison in Matthew 24, which we'll not go to. But so here, you tell me about this next one. So they'll fall by the edge of the sword. I mean, that's easy to grasp. They'll be led captive into all the nations. Now, 1.1, I think, Josephus said 1.1 million Jews in Jerusalem were killed, and nearly 800,000 were led away captive. Now, can you imagine what that would do to the slave market?
Yeah.
You,
And both books mention that.
Yeah, it's just there's so many of them. The market was glutted, and slave there's no
pay for a bottle of wine.
Yeah, and so anyway, fall by the edge of the sword, led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. You ever struggle with that one? And what did you come up with at the end of this wrestling match?
I just thought it was okay that their time was fulfilled. They won.
Or here's a thought I have, and I've run it past some guys that are bigger than I am in this study, and they said, oh, I don't think that's it. But I think I didn't explain myself well, because when I read what they thought it was, it basically saying the same thing from a different angle. Okay. I'm going to give you one reference, and Lamentations 3:15 has all four of the same elements, and it was talking about the time that Jerusalem was trampled underfoot by Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't... And so anyway, I'll just give you that. But in Revelation 11, at verse 2, watch this. Now, I take the position that Revelation is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the establishment of the new heavens and the new earth. Okay? That's my position on it. In verse 2, it says, in verse 1, a measuring rod was given to me, and someone says, rise, measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it. And leave out the court which is outside the temple, and don't measure it, for it has been given to the nations, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. Now, 42 months, there are three phrases that are used in the Bible of this period of time. 42 months. How long is 42 months if a month is 30 days?
3.5 years.
12 and a half. 1260 days, right? 430 times 40, 1260. But if you divide 42 by 24, no, by 12, you divide 42 by 12, you get 3.5. So times a half time, 3.5, 42 months, 1260 days. Those are used interchangeably in the book of Revelation. And they're talking about the time that Rome besieged Jerusalem until the temple fell.
Happened to be.
Times and a half times. Yeah. But the point I'm getting at is the city was being trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until it collapsed. And so I think that's what he's talking about, until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Dispensationalists think right now the Gentiles are ruling, but someday God is going to reestablish a temple in Jerusalem, and all the Mosaic stuff is coming back. And first of all, that doesn't make any sense, because God took Mosaic stuff out of the way because it couldn't do the job. So to reinstate it is to miss the point of the sacrifice of Jesus. Okay? It just does. Secondly, there was a second reason.
They're taking it again. They're taking it 2,000 years.
Yeah, this is this generation. See, these things will happen in this generation. Okay? So I got so excited about that first point that I forgot the second point I was going to make. Therefore, it won't be required on the test. Rachel really breathes a sigh of relief. Okay? But the... So the time of the Gentiles seems to be the time in which God allowed the Gentiles to pummel Jerusalem. Okay? And when it was over, it was over. Trample underfoot until it was over. That temple is not currently being trampled underfoot by anybody because it doesn't exist. And Jerusalem is not being trampled underfoot by the Gentiles, in the sense that the Bible used the term. So it can't be ongoing. Now, the way I took it, and basically they get to the kind of like climbing Mount Rainier from the north and from the south. When you get finished, you're at the top. You're both at the same place. Okay. And so I took it this way in day two. Nebuchadnezzar was laying on his bed. He was just agitated. What's coming after me? A guy works real hard to establish a massive empire, and he wonders, who am I going to leave it to? What's going to be like when I die? He was fretting about the future, and God gave him a dream. And I'm not going to go through all the stuff in Daniel 2 about that dream, but the dream, well, it was a head of gold, a chest and silver, and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, and then legs and feet of iron, and iron mingled with clay. Well, what is that? Well, a stone was cut without hands. You know, when a stone is cut without, when anything is done without hands, who did it? God did. Circumcision without hand, temple without hand, et cetera, various places in the Bible. Stone cut without hands. Jesus was a stone, right? Stone cut without hands hit the statue where? In the feet. And what happened to the statue? And what happened to the stone? It became a kingdom that filled the whole earth. And I posit that at the time that Jesus interacted with the Roman Empire, he crushed not the Roman Empire. He didn't die for another 300 or 400 years, but the dominion that it had over God's people was gone. See, Babylon, Assyria, it starts with Babylon, Medo-Persia, Alexander, and Rome all had shepherding dominion over God's people. When they were taken captive, God took away their king and put them under this Gentile oppression until the stone hit the statue and the statue crumbled and God's people, God's kingdom filled the earth. So I posited that the time of the Gentiles was that period of time that the Gentiles dominated God's people or dominated or ruled God's people. This has it, this Revelation 11 has it, this 3.5 years that Rome was tearing down Jerusalem and the temple. And what happened when that was done? The foreign powers no longer dominated God's people. His kingdom was born. The kingdom is at hand, as we read here. So I think you can approach it either way. That is my quickie explanation of what I think the time of the Gentiles was. I think it was the time that God allowed his people to be shepherded by this oppressive foreign power, so he could bring the Christ in and set them all free. And when he did that, they tore down the old temple so he could make the new temple. And therefore, the two ideas coincide at the same period of time. Take either one you want. I'm going to take them both, as probably what Jesus was talking about here. But he says, this is going to happen until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled, until that terminus. But we know from verse 32 that all things would take place within that generation. So even if we don't know what the collapse of the time of the Gentiles is, we know that it was up within that generation. And that's what I meant earlier. If we got something we can hang on to, we got something we can hang on to, then we don't have to try to fret out these obscure things. We can say, I think it might be this, but I know it happened then. Okay? And what he's saying is Jerusalem is going to be invaded. You're going to see it being invaded, and these are the things that are going to happen. 25 and the sun, moon, stars. What's that? That's the wrong question. Who is that, or what's he talking about? But even if we ask that question, not permitted to say, well, it hadn't happened yet, therefore it's going to happen later, when Jesus said all things will happen in this generation. Now, all that means is we don't understand what he was referring to. I've already talked about dismay among the nations and perplexity at the roaring of the seas. The stirring up of nations, the agitation, the malcontent, that was going on, perplexity over that. Well, why can't we just have peace? Okay. Well, I want to sing that. How's that song go? Bomb, 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 Iran. Yeah, but you know what came out of that was a tenuous peace. Okay, that Jesus brings peace in a different way. But the agitation of the nations. Now, sun, moon, and stars. We could go back to the dream that Joseph had. Okay, but let's talk about Joseph's dream. Joseph dreamed that the sun, moon, and stars bowed down to him. Who is he talking about? Mom, dad, and brothers. Okay, I could go to Daniel 8, in Daniel 8, it talks about the stars falling, and later explains what I'm talking about is the powerful men of the Jewish society falling. And so, sun, moon, and stars. You know, another word for all that could be celebrities. Celebrities, people of prominence, people of high visibility, star power, okay? And so leaders, prominent people, could be that's what Jesus was talking about. I know this, Rachel. It happened in that generation, whatever it is.
Well,
go ahead.
But I think that it sun, moon, and stars at the time of that Joseph was alive, it was all of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Here, I think he's saying it's all of Israel.
Yeah, it very well could be. And the mm-hmm. the rest of the agitation of the nations.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, okay. So you got both the Jew and Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
Men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world. You know what that word world is? Anybody got a... inhabited earth, that's kind of lame. That's not wrong. It's just not accurate. The Greek word is oikoumene. Oikos, oikeo means to live in a house. Oikos is house. And so oikeo is to live as in a house or the dwelling place. And this is a passive participle, or being inhabited, being dwelt in. Being dwelt in, it became how the Romans identified the boundaries of their empire, the oikoumene, that in which we are living in, and people outside of that were outsiders. So this word world is very limited in its nature, limited to the extent of the Roman Empire. I mean, that's how the word was used in that day. That's how they described their territory. The being dwelt in is literally what the word is, oikoumene, the world. And so men fainting from fear and expectation of things which are coming upon the world. Now, this is not upon South Africa or Antarctica or North America. It's on the Roman Empire. Things coming upon the Roman Empire. The agitation was very, I don't want to say local from the sense of just this little Jerusalem patch of ground, but very, very limited in that it embodied basically the Eastern Mediterranean area, the territories that were around the Eastern Mediterranean. And so a lot of agitation at that time. And the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. And this is where people flip the switch. You're going to see the Son of Man coming in power. When did they expect the Son of Man to come with power and great glory? When did they expect it?
Never mind.
See, Matthew 10 very clearly says to the 12 apostles, you will not finish the cities of Judea until the Son of Man comes. Very clear. I mean, Jesus said, I'm coming in your lifetime. I'm coming in your life. No, that doesn't fit our paradigm. That just doesn't fit what we've been handed. And yet, who has Isaiah 19? I want Isaiah 19, verse 1. Somebody read that for me. Isaiah 19, verse 1. Dum, 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 dum.
The oracle concerning Egypt.
The oracle concerning
Egypt.
Egypt. Okay, keep reading.
Behold, the Lord is riding on a swift cloud and is about to come to Egypt.
Okay. Did you know that? That the second coming was back there in the days of Isaiah? No, that, I'm not trying to say that. I'm trying to say that the language says the Lord is about to come on a swift cloud to Egypt. He's talking about Nebuchadnezzar invading Egypt. That was the coming on a cloud. Who came on the cloud? It says the Lord, but what really happened? It was an army. Now, there's two ways that an advancing army raises a cloud. Number one is when they capture a city and leave it, what do they leave it? In flames. And so you've got the cloud of smoke. Now, if they're in a hurry, their horses are kicking up a cloud of dust. You have, in the person of Nebuchadnezzar, Yahweh coming on a cloud to invade Egypt. Here, now that's right out of Isaiah 19. I'm not making that up. That's just the way that he described how the approach of Nebuchadnezzar's army, how they should understand it. That's me coming to get you. Now, if Nebuchadnezzar coming in to get the Egyptians was God on a cloud, could it not be that the royalty coming to get Jerusalem would be Jesus on a cloud? I mean, it did happen in their lifetime. It did happen in their generation. Okay? So then you will see the Son of Man coming on a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to take place, straighten up, lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. Now, we're going to have to stop there because of our time. We didn't cover as far as I had hoped to. I hope I didn't swamp anybody, but what did he mean? Your redemption is drawing near. What's redemption? Didn't Jesus pay redemption on the cross?
Yeah.
Give me a thought. Penny for a thought. Penny for a thought. Nickel for a thought. Somebody give me a thought. I'm going to read something here from Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, starting in verse 4. When he talked about in the verse 4, the persecutions and afflictions which you endure, a plain indication of God's righteous judgment. 2 Thessalonians 1, verse 5. A plain indication of God's righteous judgment, so that you may be considered worthy of the kingdom of God for which you are indeed suffering. For after all, it is just for God to repay with affliction those who afflict you, and relief to you who are afflicted. Now, Paul doesn't use the term redemption. What does redemption mean? Redeemed? Redeemed? Bought back? Bought back? So here are people who are being oppressed, afflicted, abused, and what's it? Suppressed by the enemies of God, mainly by the Jewish leadership. And God comes and destroys their temple and destroys their hierarchy. What's he doing for his people? He's redeeming them. He's buying them out of that. Or in Paul's term, granting them relief. So I think that's my answer, that your redemption is drawing near. Not that you are having your sins paid for, but you're being rescued and redeemed from the bondage that this oppression is putting you under. All right, I got to stop there. Any thoughts, comments, questions, deliberations? Okay, well, we're going to pick up there. We didn't quite get as far as we wanted to. But we'll pick up there, do some some intense next week, and we'll see how far we get. This is chewy stuff. Okay.